Blog Talk Radio.
Home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen, coming to you live from Hollywood, it's Rated G Radio with your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey everybody, welcome to Rated G Radio. I am thrilled to have you here. I hope if you celebrate Easter that you had a great visit with the Easter Bunny yesterday. I just got back from Phoenix myself. My dad turns 80 this week, and we got the entire family together and did a big birthday celebration and Easter celebration yesterday in Phoenix, and I raced back today because we have best-selling author David Pratt on the line in just a moment. He's the author of Looking After Joey, and I've been furiously reading the book all day. And I can't wait to have David tell us a little bit about the book. We'll see if he'll even do maybe a little reading from the book and all kinds of fun stuff that will be going on tonight. And he's a great storyteller, so I'm really grateful for David's time on his schedule because he's calling in from the East Coast time. Before I bring him on, I just need to give a couple of shout-outs here. Number one to Kurgan Edward Stout for connecting David and I together. And this is, I guess, Kurgan and I do Super Gay Radio once a month, and Kurgan has been a fantastic friend and a guest on the show many, many times. And so a big shout-out to Kurgan for connecting us. Here's a roadmap for the rest of the week, everybody, just to kind of give you an idea, and I'll post this on Facebook a little bit later. Tomorrow we have Xavier Sayre, and he's going to be interviewed by our Brisbane, Australia correspondent, Mary Luz. She'll be on tomorrow night talking to Xavier. Wednesday we have Massimiliano Churchi. He has a new TV show called Omega File, and he's going to be talking about that. Thursday we have author Robert Khoury. He is the author of Feed a Starving Crowd. And then Friday, Roxana returns to the Friday Night Dance Party, and she's got a new single she's promoting, and we can't wait to have her on the show. We'll be playing music selections from her album Exotica, and I can't wait to have you on for an early dance party starting at 5 o'clock. But without further ado, I want to bring our VIP special guest on the show tonight, Mr. David Pratt. David, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I sure appreciate you taking time out of your full-time, busy, crazy schedule to talk about Looking After Joey today. We're going to get to your book in just
you.
A second.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's not every day that I get one of Kurgan's friends or celebrated authors on the line, and so I'm grateful that he's made the connection, but just real thankful
me
to you
too.
For the book, because it is so much fun. But before we get to the book, because this is our first time like really chatting, we have a lot of people who either are authors, they aspire to be authors, they want to be authors when they grow up, whether they're 8 or 80 years old. And I always like to ask the authors if they could do everybody that's listening in tonight just kind of a favor and tell us a little bit about your background and what your path in life has been to get you to the point where you wanted to write some books.
Well, I was encouraged to write by a friend of mine who was a playwright. In fact, fairly well known in Canada. His name is John Mighton. In the States, he's actually known as an actor. He is Stellan Skarsgård's assistant in Good Will Hunting.
Cool.
John was primarily a playwright, and he shared an apartment with me and looked at some pages of a short story that I had lying around and got very excited and said I should be doing more of this. And so I showed him some more, and he was even more excited. And at that time, I was doing some theater and having a not great time. And so I left the theater company I was with, and I started working on these short stories. I was going to workshops here and there, but not really not very much. I was learning on my own. It was going very slowly. But after a few years, I got actually a flurry of acceptances all kind of at once. Like three within about a year.
Wow.
Christopher Street Magazine existed then, and they took something like three stories in a row.
Nice.
And that was wonderful. That was a tremendous validation because of, Christopher Street standards, because the place they held in LGBT literary history. It was really exciting to start off with them. There was also a publication called the James White Review was still being published then for several years after under a number of different editors, and I started to get some stories in there as well. So editors were knowing me, and I wrote my first novel, Bob the Book, when I was in graduate school getting an MFA in creative writing. And we were sitting around the first spring worrying that we would not keep writing over the summer. We said, how can we make ourselves keep writing over the summer? So someone counted and said, well, there are 101 days between the end of classes and the beginning of classes. What if we created something called 101 stories in 101 days, and we had a bulletin board, and you had to post your daily story or little piece of writing, whatever it was, you have to post it. And about two-thirds of the way through the summer, I'm just like, I can't do this anymore. I can't think of ideas anymore. I can't be the next George Saunders or whoever my classmates liked at the time. And, you know, for years I've been going to, like, gay lit conferences, and people would say, well, about blah, blah, gay books, and this and that about gay books. And then someone would say, well, now we have to define what we mean by a gay book. Because, you know, there's death in Venice and there's Billy Budd and that kind of borderline stuff.
Right.
And someone would always come back with, well, a gay book is a book attracted to other books of the same gender. So for this exercise, I wrote one day in July the first chapter of Bob the Book. And I thought, if this is really stupid, I'll just write something tomorrow, because that's how this exercise that we devised worked. Well, I wrote it, I posted it, and two of my classmates just jumped all over and said, oh, my God, we love this. We have to find out what happens to Bob next. I'm like, I don't know what happens to Bob next. So for 2 days, I wrote something else, and then I came back with chapter two of Bob, and then for 2 or 3 days, something else, and then chapter three. And by the time we were back in school, along with a mess of other writing, I had Bob the Book. And I submitted that to a gay novel contest run by Suspect Thoughts Press. Jameson Currier was one of the judges. He adored it. He called me up and told me if I were a publisher, I'd publish it. And, you know, that and $2 would get me on the subway, maybe $1.75 back then. But time passed. The landscape shifted. Jim became a publisher. And actually, just about 5 years ago today, almost to the day, sent me an email saying, you know how I told you I'd publish Bob the Book if I were a publisher? Well, I am. Are you still interested?
And, oh, my gosh.
So Bob the Book got published, and it is the story of a gay book. Bob is gay, and he is on the bookshelf in a gay bookstore in Greenwich Village with his gay and lesbian book friends. Mm-hmm. And he falls in love with one of them, and they're separated, and they come back together. They're separated again, and there are, you know, subplots, and there are humans who have to carry all these books around. And that got the Lambda Literary Award for debut gay male fiction the following year.
Congratulations.
Jim then subsequently gathered some of the short stories that I had out there. And Jim was a really pivotal figure because Jim knows everyone. He is old school. He belongs not quite to the generation of Felice Bacano and Edmund White, but almost, but also kind of to the generation of Christopher Bram and a lot of the people who really built the foundations of post-Stonewall gay lit in the 70s and 80s. So Jim knew everyone.
Wow.
And Jim's list of places I should go, people I should contact, places I should read, and so on, the list he gave me when Bob was about to come out, that list, I basically worked from that list and just, you know, I had a very good job at the time. I went everywhere, got into every conference, called up every bookstore owner and discovered that I have other friends who knew them. So Jim was a roadmap to how to get known. Then subsequently, all I needed to do was just call those people up again and say, I have another book. And Bob was a great sort of greeting card, business card, whatever, because it was such an odd idea that people sort of sat up and took notice. It wasn't just how it was written. It was what it was about and just how peculiar it was and funny as well. So basically, I followed Jim's roadmap and then just kept following it for each subsequent book and met more people, networked. You know, I went to Saints and Sinners, the LGBT conference in New Orleans. There I met Jerry Wheeler, who is a writer and editor, and we are taking this walking tour of gay New Orleans a couple of years ago, and he said to me, you know, if there's ever a book you want to do that's not appropriate for Jim Currier, why don't you, you know, talk to me about Wild City Press? And Looking After Joey was kind of not Jim's kind of book.
Mm-hmm.
But Wild City Press was looking to kind of move from romance over to a little more gay mainstream at the time. So Jerry became the connection that made that happen. So, you know, it was a lot of, you know, knowing, introducing myself or being introduced to, quote unquote, the right people, and then going and meeting all the people that they told me to.
Yep.
And also the inventiveness of that 101 stories in 101 days, because when my short stories came out, at least a third of them traced back to that exercise as well.
Wow.
So, you know, keep writing, set yourself goals, you know, do that stuff like National Novel Writing Month. I'm not sure how effective it is, but you do get those words churned out. Support groups, action partners. Back in the 90s, I belonged to this group of people who would meet every week and discuss the business side of writing. What had they submitted? Where had they read? What colonies were they applying to? What agent had you know, the agent's name had been dropped in their ear? All of that, as well as I was going to workshops at the same time.
How important was,
so boy,
was
25 years in one breath?
Well, that's a great breath to take. So, but let me ask you this, David, because we're going to talk for the majority of the show about your book, Looking After Joey. But you brought up so many, I think, important things for people listening tonight. Number one, you know, if somebody's out there to help you work the plan, and it sounds like mm-hmm. you aggressively did that. But one of the things that I'm very interested in, especially when people are doing anything that's creative, when you get together with people who are doing similar work, not that you're sitting there trying to copy each other, maybe you are, but when you really sit down and start talking about the nuts and bolts of the business aspect of it, you know, and it's because I think writers mm-hmm. or anybody who's doing anything creative, you start out doing it for the love of the creativity, but then the mm-hmm. ugly thing of coin comes into the conversation and there's business that you have
right.
to take care of. How difficult of a process was that for you in really working something that you're so passionate about?
Let's see. I actually, around the time I was writing Joey, for a couple of years, I had the good fortune. I've been working in development, in fundraising, and I was working for an organization that actually couldn't afford to have a director of development. It, you know, there were some big foundations that they could depend on, but
mm-hmm.
they just could not, like, grow a major donor, a major gift kind of base, so they had to let me go. And from there, I went for a number of kind of freelance, project-based, whatever you want to call it, jobs that turned out to have tons of downtime, and, like, really legitimate downtime, like everyone knew. It was no secret that there was downtime. So I started to write during the downtime. So that was very fortunate that I was able to pay the bills while kind of double dipping and getting
sure.
some stuff written. Also, although at the beginning when I was doing short stories, I had a job during the day. I'd get up very early. I'd get up at like 6, and they say, get up at 6 and write for an hour. Yes, that really works. Also, like right now I'm doing all freelance, so my schedule is very flexible. There's one client I do a lot of work for but barely ever see. You know, we struck our deal. I learned how to do the thing, and we just pass emails back and forth. So I'm very flexible. You know, once I get that work done, I can, you know, kind of rearrange the pieces of the day so that there is writing time. And you have to set aside a lot because, of course, there's writing time starts with staring at the wall time. And frequently there's staring at the wall time in between. So you often have to set aside a good couple of hours. You know, I know people who have gotten novels written while lawyering. You know, Tom Mendocino, who wrote, and of course the name of the novel would go right out of my head, but I will get Probation. Fabulous novel that came out in 2010 by Tom Mendocino. Tom's a lawyer.
Right.
So he was disciplined about, you know, doing a certain time. When you've got a story to tell and you're very excited about it and you're very excited about the act of writing, you can make it happen at 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. or 10 a.m. or for half an hour on lunch or whatever, because it pulls you back and you want to be pulled back. Also, Will Freshwater, who just put out a novel, and I am going to forget that name, but it's really terrific. You should check him out. You know, no one can forget the name Will Freshwater. Also,
no.
Also an attorney.
Cool.
So, and Jim Currier himself, who not only publishes but writes, is a paralegal for the New York Times, and that's just a crushing job. And you know, cutbacks and so forth, the Times, and so he's got like a huge workload, but you know, stays to a schedule, is passionate about both halves of his life, the publishing and the writing, and it gets done. He's producing roughly a novel a year, including a Lammy nominee for Best Mystery this year, a novel called The Gathering Storm, which is about the Matthew Shepard case, and he's also getting his publishing done. So once it gets hold of you, you will find the time.
It's, you know, I think that that's what I'm so impressed about, that, you know, especially writers, because you have such a dedication to getting either a certain word count or a certain, you know, a concept down on paper and making sure that you always, always, always write. You know, either the downtime that you have on the job or getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and doing that, that just really speaks volumes to the commitment that you have in furthering your creative endeavors here. But let's start talking a little bit about. Go ahead. I'm sorry, David.
I was going to say the commitment that the creative endeavors have to you. It's like, you know, some people say about being gay, you know, I didn't become gay or something. I was chosen. I think being an artist is kind of the same thing. That force or compulsion or whatever it is chooses you. And so, you know, you will make it work or you will be unhappy. So you make it work. And
it's
really not a burden. It feels like it. If someone, oh my God, you got up at 5:30. Oh my God, I could never. But you know, you look forward to it.
Right.
Chris Shirley, the author of Playing by the Book. I did a reading with him in Boston, and someone asked about, you know, the work of it, and somebody said, "Oh, I get to do it. It's like every day is like Christmas. I get to write."
I love that. Isn't that nice to be able to do something every day that just makes your heart happy?
Yeah, yeah. Or terrified sometimes, but you know.
it's the good terrified, David. You know, it's like, you know.
It's a good,
it's the good kind.
There's nothing like, you know, it's hard to face the problem sometimes, but there's nothing like that moment when you solve the problem or that moment when the characters suddenly do something on their own that kind of challenges you or takes things in an interesting direction, which happened in Joey.
Yeah. So let's talk about your book, Looking After Joey, here. So how long did it take you to actually write this book compared to, you know, Bob the Book, which you wrote in about, you know, 6 seconds by comparison, I'm going to guess.
Yeah. Let's see. Joey was probably, all right, started in 2012. Finished in early 2013, and then there were some revisions, and I think if it came out just about exactly a year ago, that I finished it up after Christmas 2013, a little less than 2 years.
That's not bad at all.
And it comes from a short story in my short story collection. The story is called Calvin Gets Sucked In, which is the same as the name of the first part of Looking After Joey.
Sure.
And that's just Calvin visiting the porn world, Calvin getting sucked into the porn video and living inside it. And then I thought, you know, there should be another short story about Joey coming into this world. And I said, no, if Joey comes into this world, that's a novel. Because
yeah, you get a book.
He'd be terrified and he'd run right back. So we have to make it so that somehow he can't get back. And then once Calvin is stuck with him, the fun begins, especially because Calvin calls upon his friend Peachy, who has a million billion dangerous ideas about how to handle this poor boy in their midst.
Well, can you tell the listeners just a little bit about what Looking After Joey is about? Because, I've now read about half the book, and if it weren't for the fact that we were talking tonight, I would still be reading the book because it is so much fun. But you dive into the book so quickly, you don't even realize, you know, you start with page one, and the next thing you know, you're 100 pages in going, where did the time go? Because, you know, you just keep turning the pages because you can't believe what's happening next.
Yeah, I couldn't believe either. The hero of Looking After Joey is Calvin, who is a 40-ish accountant in New York City. He's single. And instead of putting himself out there to find a man the way his friend Peachy wants him to, Calvin is kind of depending upon porn and using porn as a crutch. And he has a crush on this one porn star named Joey Rhodes. And one night, Calvin is sitting in the living room watching porn, and he suddenly finds himself being invited into the porn video by another porn star named Rod Packer, and that is Rod spelled R-O-D-D-D, Packer. And so Calvin's inside this porn video, and he is searching for Joey. And he finds him, and he begs him to come home with him, to cross back into our world. And Joey is scared, but then so Calvin comes back by himself, and you know he's kind of lonely and feeling mopey again. But a couple of nights later, ba-boom, there's Joey. Calvin has been watching the porn video again, and he left it on, and suddenly Joey is in his world. He finds he can't go back, and so Calvin calls up his friend Peachy. Peachy is one of those socially adept, know-it-all gay men who has three lemon zesters and a chocolate fork and knows the best cast recording of A Little Night Music and that sort of thing. And Peachy embarks on a program to teach Joey everything he needs to know to be a gay man in New York City. And what they plan to do to sort of test Joey is after he has learned how to be a gay man in contemporary New York City, they're going to take him to this fabulous party on Fire Island at the end of the summer. And sort of that will be his coming out in a way socially.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of ripped off from My Fair Lady. In fact, at one point, Calvin turns to Peachy and says, "So what you're offering me here is My Fair Lady and a walk up in Chelsea with no music and no Julie Andrews." And Peachy says, "We sound a little bitter, don't we?"
Uh-huh.
So, and then along the way, the misadventures start because they have to get invited to this party. And so Peachy starts trading favors with this rather insane cast of characters who are there mostly to be insane. I sort of just decided to pile on as much as I could and just have lots of fun. As we were discussing before we went on the air, the fact that they get to the party is not necessarily a spoiler because you kind of think, you know, what's all this buildup about the party and what's going to happen at the party if they're not going to get there. But a number of rather wacko things happen at the party. A number of plot threads come together at the party. And when they come home from it, life sort of, it's the end of the summer, fall is coming. Joey has learned how to get along in this world, and so there's a matter of sort of what's next for everyone. And the boyfriend problem resurfaces for Calvin. There's this sudden, after this summer of madness, there is this return to normalcy, and it's a little autumnal, and you feel the chill a little bit, but you also feel the coziness of the family that these people have formed. I would say the last third of it is a little more serious than the rest of it. And some other stuff happens that kind of makes it.
Well, you got to read the book, so we don't want to give it all away.
You got to read the book.
Read the book.
Yes.
So, what inspired this story? How in the world did you come up with something like this? Because it just seemed like something I've never read before, and was just you just find yourself neck deep in the story before you even realize what's hit you.
I forget how I came up with my original short story that I wrote called Calvin Gets Sucked In. I honestly forget the origin of that. I probably wrote it as part of that 101 stories exercise, and all
cool.
of those were just thought up so fast. You know, it's 9 a.m. Oh, my God, I have to write my story for the day or my classmates are going to think I'm lame. So
right.
I'll write about that fly on the wall. I'll write about a guy getting sucked into a porn video. Okay, go.
Sure.
Then, you know, I guess it just seemed logical to me. Joey should, you know,
come
what would it be like for
right?
Joey in this world? And in fact, the comic possibilities would be greater. Calvin goes into the porn world.
Right.
It's very funny, but the possibility, after a while, everything that can happen to someone in a porn film has happened to him because there's not that much that can happen. Joey coming into this world, two things, much more can happen. So it's much funnier. And also, some very serious and odd stuff can happen. If you think about a porn character, not a porn actor, but a porn character, all they know is like sex, pizza, and surfing.
Right.
So they come into the real world, and literally everything is a misadventure or a misunderstanding or a question. And so I thought, well, some possibility for a lot of comedy here, but also some very poignant stuff. I'm trying to think of an example. Well, one example, I won't give away too much, but you know, Joey's in this world where time passes, and he discovers that his hair and his fingernails grow. And, of course, practically that can be taken care of very easily, but it weirds him out that he's aging.
Right.
And, of course, Karen at 40 is having aging issues too, so it's an interesting thing. So I just took the ball and ran with it, and then a lot of some of the crazy characters who come up when they start trying to figure out how to get to the party, you know, the Englishman, Sir Desmond Norma, I had sort of created that character, but because I'm not an actor, I didn't have anything to do with it. I just had this character named Sir Desmond Norma who sort of talked about, you know, lads and things. And I was like, and then who else? Stuart Bergman is based on a dear friend of mine, and I engaged in a day of trash talking at a book fair some years ago. And so I'll not say Stuart is based on that friend, but Stuart's tone is certainly based on the way this friend and I sort of trash talked to each other. So that was a lot of fun. And, you know, Bunce Van Den Troll is sort of everything I hate about pretentious social climbing gay men. But poor Bunce really takes the brunt of my satirical viciousness in looking after Joey. Everyone piles on Bunce, including me.
So
I had a chance to use a lot of different gay types and gay situations that have been floating around in my head and needed something to attach to. So here I have this insane plot with a Fire Island party and everything. I just piled them all on.
So do you relate to any of the characters more than others? Or do you have a favorite character out of this?
Certainly, I relate well to Calvin. I like Doug a lot, you know, and I'm not going to say who Doug is because then you have a spoiler.
No spoilers.
There's a character named Doug who kind of stands outside all of the gay social madness of the other characters, although he's very much a part of their lives. And he participates in the parties and the dinners and so forth. But Doug is, for reasons I will not disclose, a little outside it all. And I find him extraordinarily attractive and admirable. It's not that he judges. It's not that he rejects the other characters partying. It's just there's kind of something different at his core. Peachy, of course, I think is quite a stitch. I admire the kinds of stuff Peachy can get done. Peachy's a doer. That's not all there is in life, and it's one of the points in the book. You know, Peachy's way of dealing has its limits, but I admire that Peachy, you know, wades into a situation at 7 o'clock in the morning and says, "Okay, here's what we're going to do."
Right.
You know, it sounds crazy, but here's what you're going to do, Calvin. Here's what you can't do with this. Here's what you will do. Here's how the summer will go. So I like him too. I like Stuart Bergman a lot, the publisher. And he's the most uninhibited. He says exactly what he thinks, you know, times 10. I only wish that these scenes with Stuart didn't require so much backstory, because then I'd read one of them in a reading. I would love to read Stuart, but any scene he's in, there's like tons of backstory.
Right, right.
And then who else? I mean, I love Desmond. He's just so much fun writing Desmond.
Do you have maybe a selection you'd like to share with the listeners tonight?
Sure. There
it's
is.
Like, which one to pick? Because there's, you know, 10 million that are just great.
There is there's a section from when Peachy is first attempting to teach Joey how to be a gay man. You know, and of course there's a problem. You know, in these gay porn films, the guys are never gay, right? Just
right.
Like they have needs and the girlfriend is away for the weekend, or they
right.
do it for the money or something. But Peachy's idea of teaching someone to be a gay man is teach them all the cultural stuff. Teach them about musicals and divas and things. So Peachy comes up with this very elaborate plan, and then it kind of derails because kids will never learn the things you want them to learn. So they've just been out to dinner for the first time. They've taken Joey out of the apartment to a restaurant for the first time. It's not gone well. It's had some funny parts and it's had some serious parts, but it's not gone well. So they're back regrouping in the apartment.
Okay, cool.
Back in the apartment, they let Joey channel surf. They found that he was not equipped to watch just anything because he did not understand concepts of time and space, nor could he distinguish fiction from nonfiction. So he believed drone strikes or tsunamis on the news were happening right there. Calvin finally found a Michael Jackson tribute that dazzled Joey sufficiently without scaring him. Peachy and Calvin retired to the kitchen. Okay, Peachy said, seating himself at the table and pulling out his knapsack. While I was at home, I did up a little list of cultural markers that our boy is going to have to know to survive with Fred's crowd. That's at the party. He pulled out a sheaf of papers, each with an Excel grid filled with tiny type. Now, what I have done, he said, is to divide standard homosexual knowledge into six tracks. We have a cinema and television track, a music track, a theater and literature track, a visual arts and fashion track, and a world history and current events track. I am currently selecting films, plays, cast albums, novels, and so forth, in which the dumpling must become versed by Labor Day. Casting his eyes over the sheets, Calvin saw familiar names. Betty Davis, Stephen Sondheim, Cyndi Lauper, Harvey Milk. You're absolutely sure he can read? Peachy asked. If not, it's okay. I have a plan B. Excerpts of printed works can be read to him. You hardly have to read all of Goodbye to Berlin. That, by the way, is a perfect example of what I fondly call a linkage. I have planned certain days to accommodate multiple versions of the same thing. In one day, for example, he is slated to read a selection from Isherwood's Berlin stories, listen to excerpts from the cast album of Cabaret, and then see the film. This transitions into a unit on Liza Minnelli, and God, don't I wish I had an extra 2 hours to screen the vastly underrated Tell Me That You Love Me, Junie Moon, but we have to show the full Liza with a ZTV special, so there goes that. Then, and I think this is a stroke of genius, we move back in time to do a unit on Judy, ending with The Wizard of Oz, which will simultaneously be the beginning of a unit I call American Innocence, Found and Lost, which will contain works from all six tracks. I'm thinking in the end I can put it all together as a book to help guys just coming out. I can sell it in bus stations. Peachy, Calvin opined, aren't we going to have to teach him a lot more basic stuff? Has he ever seen walk, don't walk signs? Can he cross the street without getting us all in trouble? I think the answer would be no, and the subway is going to terrify him. Well, that's where you come in, Peachy said. That's what you are good at, while moi excels in the exegesis of Liza with a Z. And so the evening went. The Michael Jackson special ended. It was cool, Joey allowed. I mean, he danced good and everything, but he didn't have sex with anyone. Oh, child, Peachy sighed, you don't want to know. Well, Calvin said, he danced well. So, kids, Peachy announced, I'm off. I'll see you on the morrow. You, he said, pointing to Joey, have a big day ahead of you. Yeah, said Joey. Am I going to have sex? Better, said Calvin. You were going to learn about musical theater. Huh? Joey said. Never mind, said Peachy. Just be dressed and showered and fed by 9. Joey agreed. Peachy tootalooed off, and Calvin explained to Joey that they were going to teach him a few survival skills tomorrow because they wanted to take him to a swank party and he'd have to learn about their world so that he could fit in. Maybe, Calvin added encouragingly, he'd find someone to have sex with. That satisfied Joey, and he went to sleep a happier, if still anxious, boy. Shall I go on to what happens the next day?
Yes.
Okay.
Is this available on tape, or is it just, you know, because I'm just reading the version that you sent over, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to read that. But is it available on tape?
It is not yet. It is not. I'm trying to figure out. I want to do that. But I want to record it myself.
Yeah.
I don't want someone to record it for me. So I've got to like figure out how to find a lash up and all that.
Okay,
but,
because I could sit here and listen to you all day, just because I feel like I know the characters now. But then hearing you read the characters, it's, oh my gosh, this is fun. So if you want to go on, I know people would love it.
Sure. So as we all know, children don't always learn exactly what you think you're teaching them. So the following day, Peachy arrived at 20 to 9, hyperventilating. Oh, I was up all night, he panted, dumping DVDs and CDs onto Calvin's table. I completely redid the Sondheim unit, but I have no idea what I'm going to do about the Lost Generation. It would kill me to cut Juna Barnes unless... Ooh, hi, Joey! The latter had come from the bathroom, toweling his hair. Sit, 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 said Peachy. As Joey slowly consumed egg whites, toast, and ginger ale, Peachy explained to him the cultural education he was about to undergo. Peachy immediately hit a snag upon stating that there are certain things every gay man has to know. To which Joey said, Whoa, I'm not gay. Sorry, Calvin said to Peachy, I forgot to tell you about this. I'm not queer, Joey said, wrinkling his nose. It's just like I got needs. And plus, my girlfriend's away for the weekend. Peachy made a high-pitched squeak. Peach, said Calvin, let me handle this. Joey, what's your girlfriend's name? I don't know. Where did she go? I don't know. But she's away for the weekend. Yeah? Joey, Calvin said, do you know what a weekend is? Sure, Joey said. What is it? It's, Calvin turned to Peachy. You might want to hold off on Juna Barnes, he said. He turned back to Joey. A weekend, he said, is a period of 2 days. Huh? Said Joey. Saturday, Sunday, 2 days. This is a weekend right now that we're in. That is why Peachy and I are not working. At our jobs, anyway. We'll talk about jobs later. Do you have sex at your jobs? Joey asked. If only, Peachy sighed. This, Calvin continued, is a holiday weekend, so it lasts 3 days. Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Today is Sunday. Okay. Tomorrow is Monday, the special magical third day of this 3 day weekend. It is called Memorial Day weekend. 3 months from now, we will have another 3 day weekend, Labor Day weekend. That's when we are taking you to the fancy party, so that's in 3 months. Uh-huh, said Joey. What's a month? Peachy took deep breaths as Calvin taught Joey how to read a calendar and a clock. So what Peachy is going to teach you, Calvin said, seeing the former's impatience, is what guys like you who have sex with other guys talk about and do, because here, like we said last night, most men have sex with women. Ignoring Joey's dismayed expression, Calvin continued, guys here who have sex with other guys, there are not a lot of us. We get kind of left out of all the stuff that guys who do have sex with women do. Thus, we tend to make up special worlds of our own, to which Peachy will now introduce you. Oh, was all Joey said. Then he asked when he would get to have sex. Soon, Calvin said, once you've listened to Peachy for a bit, we'll go out. Just to look around. Sex is not easy here, but it can be great. It will be especially great for you, but we're going to get there slowly, okay? I guess. Good. Peachy, go. Joey hugged his knees to his chest. Calvin placed an encouraging hand on his back right along his spine. It felt good. Peachy sprang to life. Okay, so, literature track. From the pile of media, he pulled a copy of Christopher Isherwood's Berlin Stories and plopped it in front of Joey. Now, he began, a long time ago, in a faraway land called Germany, there were some very bad people called Nazis. Calvin Winston shook his head. What? Peachy demanded. Too heavy, said Calvin. Did they have sex a lot? Joey asked. As with the Michael Jackson thing, Calvin said, you really don't want to know the answer to that. Wait, Peachy gasped, a perversions track. Why didn't I think of it before? The germane thing, Calvin said, as you see from this pile of books and movies, is guys who have sex with other guys tend to read and watch lots of movies and TV, and they also like to make up their own books and shows and so on. Peachy sat back, deflated. Calvin identified Broadway and Hollywood as two loci of cultural activities for guys who have sex with other guys. Fearing Peachy felt left out at his own party, Calvin explained that this man, Isherwood, was involved in both Hollywood and Broadway. Over to you, Peachy said, and Peachy launched into a creditable history of Sally Bowles and the stage and film versions of Goodbye to Berlin. After a couple of minutes, Calvin suggested maybe it's time for a visual aid. The three of them adjourned to the living room for a screening of Cabaret. Soon there was trouble. In one scene in the film version of Cabaret, Michael York, as the Isherwood character, is sitting in a beer garden drinking and making eyes at Helmut Grime. An eerily beautiful blonde boy in a Hitler Youth outfit stands and begins to sing a National Socialist anthem called Tomorrow Belongs to Me. Wow, Joey exclaimed, scampering across the carpet right up to the TV. He's beautiful. Can I have sex with him? Peachy seized the remote and hit pause. No, he said. One, we do not speak the film. That was explained to everyone beforehand. And two, that is a Nazi. Joey cowered in the glow of the TV. The point of this scene, if you would wait for it to develop, is that, Peachy, Calvin interrupted, you have to admit it is a natural question for him. And he added, turning to Joey, the natural answer is no. It took some time to restore order. Peachy explained again that one did not talk during a movie, especially in a scene like this one with a goosebump-inducing build, as beer garden patrons stood and joined the song. No one is going to have sex in this movie, Peachy admonished, and not the way you think of it. Peachy rewound and started again. Joey stared in obedient silence at first, then began to hum the song. Calvin signaled to Peachy to let it be. After the film was over, as Peachy tried to explain about Liza Minnelli and her even more famous mother, all Joey could ask about was other movies that featured this young man or other young men like him. He wondered if he could cross over into Cabaret in the way he and Calvin had crossed between there and here. Peachy, meanwhile, was lecturing on Cabaret's place in the history of filmed musicals. Barbara had just done Hello, Dolly, of course, he said. And Joey asked hopefully, are there Nazis in that? And that makes a good stopping place.
Oh, David, I could listen to you just read the entire night. This is just, it is so much fun. So everybody who's listened to the show tonight.
I had fun writing it. It was a blast to write.
Then I'm going to just say you need to keep writing more books like this. Everybody who's listening to the show tonight, there's a little video that you can watch on the book. There's a link to Amazon to buy David's book, Looking After Joey. You can buy it and one click it, or however the cool kids do it, go and support the cause tonight. What else should people know about your writing and your short stories and the other work that you are working on?
Let's see. About the short stories, they should know that might be my favorite of my three books. I hesitate to say it a little bit because, you know, in Bob the Book, I posit this world where books hear and see and speak and have feelings, and so I'm afraid the other two books will have their feelings hurt if I say I like the short stories the best. But there is a lot of strangeness and emotion and successful literary experimentation going on in the short stories that's not quite as present in the novels. I think partly it's the nature of short stories. You know, you can try crazy shit. Can I say that on the air? On the internet, wherever we are.
A
lot of crazy shit you can try in short stories, and if it doesn't work, you just write another one, and if it does work, you know, there you have a published short story and maybe part of an anthology. So there's some very, like, dreamlike stories. There's some stories where, like, very disparate threads are woven together. Then there's some that are quite conventional. And Calvin Gets Sucked In is in there, you know, the origin of Joey.
Sure,
so I try to steer people toward the short stories as well. The collection is called My Movie. And, you know, Bob the Book is still out there going strong, or somewhat strong, after 5 years almost. And that's a lot of fun also. It's like Joey, it's kind of a caper, although the humans kind of control the picaresque adventure in Bob the Book. The books sort of are able to telepathically influence them from time to time, but they're also a bit at the mercy of the people, and so the books get shuffled, you know, and lovers come together and then lose each other, and friends come together and lose each other. let's see, what I'm writing now, I've finished up a young adult novel.
So where do, as a writer, because you write on so many very different topics here, do you have, I mean, how do you get inspiration? Because, you know, a lot of people write crime novels, or a lot of people write romance novels, or a lot of people, you know, and you're not, it doesn't seem like you're pigeonholing yourself into a particular genre.
I'm not. I actually set the goal a few years ago of trying a bunch of different genres. My, you know, doing the young adult thing is one of those experiments, and I had a lot of fun. And I actually can't remember what the origin of that book was. You know, where the ideas come from, they're all over the place. You know, especially some of the short stories. I remember very well the origins of some of the short stories. I'd meet someone, or I'd read a story in the paper, or something would happen to me specifically, or I'd take something that happened to me and kind of marry it to something, to a strange story in the paper, or to just a passing scene that I saw. I thought, you know, I meet someone in passing out. What if I knew that person?
Mm-hmm.
What would be their like? What's their story? I remember years ago, I was on vacation on Cape Cod, and I bought a bus ticket from about the saddest-looking young man I had ever seen.
Mm.
There's just like this tragic look to him, and he did not have like a great face to begin with. But that's really is neither here nor there. It was really how just angry and sad he seemed that made him unattractive, strikingly unattractive. So I wrote a short story imagining his life, or imagining his summer. And it's in my movie, the short story collection. It's called Not Pretty. And indeed, it's not just about a person whose tumultuous feelings make him not pretty. It's about a whole situation that's not pretty.
Yeah. Oh, how powerful.
That he is in. He's determined to go away by himself for the summer and work, and his father is against it. So his father says, you know, I bet you'll spend all the money on housing and stuff. He says, at the end of the summer, I'll give you a dollar for every dollar you manage to keep. Of course, figuring the kid won't make anything.
Right.
And
right.
Part of what the story is about is the tortures the kid puts himself through in order to save money. And almost degrading situations that he puts himself in order not to spend. And then he walks into the middle of a sexual situation, or two sexual situations in a row, and so the whole money sex thing, how we treat ourselves sexually, how we treat ourselves in terms of money. And so there's personal stuff in that, but there was also trying to imagine the life of, you know, this person was just so strikingly angry and unhappy. But I just want to take my bus ticket and run. And so, I mean, he's going to get a story.
Wow.
So, and then of course, Bob, the book just started from a gag.
Right.
And me having to write something that day and having nothing else to write and thinking, oh, yeah, that old gay book joke. Okay, let's see what we can do with this.
And here, you know, and you get a fantastically selling, you know, piece of history with that. So with Bob the book. So as we're getting ready
for that. Who knows?
Well, yeah, isn't that funny? You know, it's like, you know, some of the best ideas that you have are when you really are under the gun, and it's like, you know, I've got an hour before I've got to meet my deadline, and I have nothing on the piece of paper yet, and then boom, there you go. I'm just always impressed with people like you, David. That just really is so telling about your abilities as a writer, and it's just as a creative soul. As we get ready to kind of wrap things up here tonight, do you have preferred ways for people to find you on social media and kind of hang out with you?
Sure. I'm on Twitter, but I haven't been using it lately. I should more. I'm on Facebook, and I use it a lot. And let's see, those would kind of be the two major things. I don't have a website. I sort of let my publisher's websites be my website. So ChelseaStationEditions.com, Chelsea like Joni Mitchell's Chelsea Morning, ChelseaStationEditions.com has Bob the book and my movie, and Wild City, and that's Wild with an E, like Oscar, WILDECity.com has Looking After Joey. And also if you Google, I did a blog tour for Looking After Joey, and there's some really, I think, very nice essays, also, you know, written under duress, because a lot of bloggers, quite understandably, want original content, and the dates were very close together, so I was just grinding out the stuff about how I came up with this character and how my writing technique was influenced by this. And so if you kind of Google, I guess, you know, Pratt looking after Joey blog, you know, I was on Prism Book Alliance, you know, with Brandy Lynn, on Top Down Under, was it Three Chicks After Dark? It's some great.
Wow.
Because, you know, Wild City is a romance, an MM romance publishing concern. And, you know, Joey's just enough romantic that the men and women who run these sites, many, many women, but also some men, were really quite taken with it. So
good for you.
They really embraced it. So a lot of little interviews and little essays out there, if you cull through some of those blogs. And Kaza K was lovely at On Top Down Under. She actually had me back as a guest a second time, and then Joey was one of her top 10 for the year, and the cover was one of the top 10 for the year, designed by Adrian Nicholas.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
City guy. Yeah.
Well,
so that's how you find me. A little Googling digs me up.
Okay, so everybody's going to Google. Everybody's going to go buy the book tonight, and they're, again, go watch the little video clip on the page as well. For our budding writers out there, old and new, last words of wisdom for anybody who is out there who wants to write.
Let's see. Well, you're already writing. You know, if you want to, you should already be. I'm not sure about, you know, someone says they want to, but they're not doing it yet. They may be blocked. They may have a lot of ideas, in which case I would say, you know, write anything. Remember, you don't have to show it to anyone. You don't even have to show it to yourself. It may turn out badly the first time, but the second or third or fourth or fifth time, it might not. You know, I found that I was drawn to do it even if I didn't like the result, and I was then drawn to revise it and drawn to revise it again. And, you know, some people hate revising. I was just pulled back to it and back to it. You know, I loved to tinker.
Go ahead. Can I ask you maybe like, you know, your experience like workshops? Because you talked a lot about, you know, collaborating or just, you know, going and sharing your love of writing in workshops and other events like that. How important do you think that is for today's writer?
I think it still is very important. I think it's very important to do it in person, even if you do connect by social media, which I think can also be important. You know, you might meet a writer very far away who you never would have met. That's happened to me. Or a blogger or a reviewer who you never would have met, or a publisher you never would have met. So using the social media and the electronic part of it's very important. But I think being in a room with other people who are trying to do the same thing you're doing is important. I don't know that an MFA program is the answer. If you're lucky enough to be one of the people who the MFA professors decide is a star, it can be very good for you. If you're not one of those people, maybe just running regular workshops of your own or having a so-called action group you get together with is just as good. An MFA does provide you with a program of stuff to read and a program of stuff to write, and you do have to turn it in on time, and other people will read it and will critique it. It's very scheduled. I'm not sure you could quite reproduce that out in the world on your own, but I've known people who successfully have. Or sometimes, you know, they'll take a programmed course or workshop or MFA program or something and then stick with those people afterward and continue to meet in homes and in cafes. And that I've had that happen too, you know, taking a course, and then we all say, well, we can't break up. We have to keep meeting.
Gotta stay
together. It can go on longer than the course ever went on or longer than the MFA ever went on. I think contact with other writers is good. You know, you don't want to get too lost in people's evaluation of your stuff or, you know, start to get all foggy and confused because 20 people have 20 different opinions.
Sure.
Nor do you want to get too much caught up in the social part of it. I sort of have a tendency to be a little introverted and a little keeping to myself, so I'm not going to get too swept up in the social part. But the social part's important. Like when I was just at Saints and Sinners, which I mentioned before, in New Orleans, and the going out to dinner and the having drinks and the just hanging out, it is important. You develop a kind of rapport, even if you're not even talking about writing, that people start to think of you as part of the family. So they'll think to ask you, would you like to contribute to this anthology? Would you like to contribute to my new fiction website? Would you like to review? I know someone who can blurb your new book. It's that guy we had dinner with. So, yeah, some of that is definitely important. And I would, if one is away from the major metropolitan centers, I'd budget the money to come to something like Outright at the D.C. Center in Washington, D.C. every summer, or to Saints and Sinners, or, if you do gay romance, go to Gay Rom Lit. I would budget at least one thing like that a year, especially if you're not in a part of the country where you see a lot of figures in the writing world all the time.
Excellent advice. Everybody, it's been best-selling author David Pratt. His book is Looking After Joey. Go buy it and support the cause, as we say. Again, tomorrow night we're going to have Mary Lou Life from Brisbane, Australia. She'll be on the show, and we're going to be doing an interview with Xavier Sayre. And then Wednesday, Massimiliano Churchi. I screw it up every time. His new TV show is The Omega File, and we've got more excitement coming on for the rest of the week. David, it's been a pleasure having you here. I can't wait to have you back to talk more about your writing in the future. You're a delight, and you're always welcome, so just know that.
Thank you.
And,
it's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure being on.
Thank you so very, very much. I know you have a lot of other things you could be doing, and I'm grateful to you for taking time out of your night tonight. And
not so many as you think. My life.
Well,
my life is not quite a cabaret.
It's I always think these writers, you're writing these stories, and it's like, so I picture you kind of, living this, looking after Joey type of life where it's just, crazy and all the fun things that are going on. But that's probably part of the beauty of being a writer, though. So, thank you very much.
This weekend.
There you go.
Get out there
and celebrate. Hopefully you'll have some warmer weather. And everybody, we'll see you live on Tuesday night. Don't drive distracted. David, thanks again, and we'll see everybody tomorrow night.
Okay, take care.
Thanks, David. Bye.
Thanks.